Wanted to ask first about your first experience with mathematics, what you remember way back.
Well, if I can expand that a little bit to science. Yes.
Okay.
In the fourth grade, I went to the Hayden Planetarium in New York, mm-hmm. which has now been renamed. But mm-hmm. And I learned about the planets, and I got totally fascinated with the planets. And for example, did you know that the diameter of Jupiter is 80,000 miles through the poles, but through the equator, it's 88,000 miles. Now, I know these because I learned them in the eighth grade. I don't have a good memory, but I had the memory of a fourth grader. So, and so I just liked the ideas of science. In college, I was studying math and physics, but I really didn't like experiments. Mm-hmm. I always felt the experiments would simply show how little I could do. It showed my incompetence. And of course, I was familiar with the great telescopes, for example, which would look out into space, a 200-inch Palomar telescope. And so I was all in favor of somebody doing these experiments, and I'm considering astronomy to be experimental in that sense, but I didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. For example, you grind a lens and you're a little bit off and it looks crummy. So mm-hmm.
So how did the math component work with that kind of interest?
I like an awful lot of stuff in science. Mm-hmm. And I tell people I don't know what mathematics is. Okay. You don't have to believe me, but I mean, right now, I'm working on, I'm going to be talking on chaos, but most of my work is on genomes, trying to determine the DNA sequence of species. And my group is real good at it. We're working on the genome of the pine tree, trying to determine the sequence with a group of other people. And our goal is they break the DNA into fragments, and they overlapping fragments, and you try to put it together like a jigsaw puzzle as much as you can. And is that mathematics? No, it's logical. It's the logical algorithms you've got to create, and it's logical thinking. Mm-hmm. And mathematics is logical thinking.
So you went to Columbia University?
Yes.
Did you also grow up in New York?
Nearby, Jersey.
New Jersey. Uh-huh. You went to Columbia with an interest majoring in mathematics and physics. Were there particular things that stood out for you that kept you going in that direction?
Well, French.
Which means?
Liberal arts. Well, I was not a good student. Uh-huh. I had remarkably bad grades. Because I am a bit error prone. Mm-hmm. For example, in high school, the high school I went to had annual numerical grades. So mm-hmm. if you took an English course, yeah. you got a numerical grade. And you took four courses a year for 4 years, you got 16 grades. And the highest grade I got in anything was an 86, which might have been physics. And then mm-hmm. one math course might have been an 85, but now, at the same time, I have a little pin from the MAA, which I was told means I was in the top 100 in the national contest. Mm-hmm. And in the state contest of Rutgers, the long answer question, I was third in mm-hmm. high school. So I had a lot of abilities, but they didn't show up in tests. You see, I wasn't very good at learning and memorizing a problem. So if you showed mm-hmm. me how to do it, I try to understand it, mm-hmm. and you show me it again, it might take me a while to figure it out. You show me a completely different problem, it might take me just as long to figure it out, because I could do problems I'd never seen before, mm-hmm. but I wasn't terribly good at reproducing what they wanted me to reproduce. And I found out later on, many, many years later, there was actually a guy who got a 96 in geometry. And so I was way behind. It's not that everybody mm-hmm. got B's. Mm-hmm. So it's the error prone. And also, mm-hmm. You make numerical mistakes. And In the seventh grade, they split the class into half, those who could do math and those who couldn't. So I wound up in the class who couldn't, and we learned how to read gas meters and write checks and things like that. And I caught up by taking a trig course over a summer, and then I took calculus in my senior year. And then I wanted to get into an advanced course in Columbia, so I read Helmholtz's finite dimensional vector spaces over the summer, and this was the professor required me to do this in order to be able to get into the class. And so then I got into the class, and class did things like the vague integration as, you know, a couple week segment, and just all kinds of wonderful stuff and topology. And
so was this as a freshman?
Yeah.
Already.
So I took a big jump over it. And I didn't get very good grades, and I only got one A in my first 3 years of college, which was gym. And so you see, I'm not a good student. But I did moderately well in the Putnam. And I think that got me into graduate school. So I was 40th and 42nd. And one professor wrote as a recommendation that I was, did much better than anybody else from Columbia. So, I think these exams are good at bringing out a certain kind of personality, such as myself. And it took me 6 semesters to get through a 4-semester French requirement. That's the French. See, I didn't. I wasn't tempted to go into languages and and such. And what I've always liked to do is read about all kinds of science, like your books, for example, which are, you know, it opened doors to people in high school. And so I really value these popular books. We used to be able to buy paperback books for 35 cents, you know, 1, 2, 3, Infinity by Gamow. And you learn a great deal. You learn about countability and uncountability in a paperback that you bought at the soda store.
So when you're trying to make choices about graduate school, why Maryland?
Well, I got pretty much identical offers from Maryland and Cornell. And at the time, Cornell was a very pure department. And since then,
it's changed a bit.
It's changed a lot. In fact, a couple faculty members from Maryland went up to Cornell in my first 2 years. They got hired away from us. But there was the Institute for Fluid Dynamics and Applied Mathematics, which intrigued me as a possibility that one could actually do applied math. Now, I felt my abilities were in topology. So what do you do with topology if you want to do an applied math track in some sense? And, well, what's chaos? But chaos is it's a lot of topology, if you want to look at it that way. It's a lot of measure theory, it's a lot of numerics, it's everything, because almost everything is chaotic. There are certain things you can say. Almost everything is statistics, for example. Almost everything is optimization. Almost everything is chaos. Almost everything is geometry. These are all true, but it depends on your orientation. And I liked the kind of problems I really liked are problems where nobody knew much about them. I didn't like, when I was in graduate school, one of the big areas was linear operators. And there was a huge knowledge of that one should know to go into this field, and that wasn't my orientation. So, I did not actually succeed in graduate school in being very applied. Mm-hmm. And I got into differential equations. I switched out of infinite dimensional Riemannian geometry. Mm-hmm. But I got into differential equations, and which I felt a real intuition for. And the Riemannian geometry questions, I felt, well, just going through the motions mm-hmm. of trying to extend results from finite dimensions to infinite dimensions, and just didn't, you know, mm-hmm. didn't pick me up. Mm-hmm. And the differential equations did movement. You got to understand mm-hmm. movement. And so I felt I had an intuition for movement. Mm-hmm. Differential equations with time delays.
Mm-hmm. So who were strong influences at that time?
People sometimes talk about their mentors as some yeah. professor and mm-hmm. here or there. My mentors really were two people. Mm-hmm. One was Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. And as far as your mentors are concerned, if it's a professor, you may not know very much about this professor. Right. I knew a great deal about Einstein. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really appreciated about Einstein was his ability to look at completely unrelated problems and come up with interesting things to say. Now, I know I'm not an Einstein. I never expected to be an Einstein, but still I thought I could look at different problems that are unrelated mm-hmm. and say interesting things. Certainly not at his level, but at an interesting level. Mm-hmm. So rather than lock into a particular area, I felt I could move around. Mm-hmm. And so I started working in population dynamics, and I studied, for example, gonorrhea epidemics. I have a book with Heathcote, and studied algebraic topology and differential equations and control theory. Now, the other mentor was Norbert Wiener, mm-hmm. who by chance, my advisor's 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 advisor was Norbert Wiener. But Norbert Wiener was a book writer. He wrote several popular books. Mm-hmm. And you really learn about him, from his point of view at least. Where did I learn control theory? Feedback control. I would say I learned it from a science fiction book that Norbert Wiener wrote. He wrote one science fiction book, and if my memory is right, that's the book where he talked about ships which have rudders that are controlled. So you want to steer the ship, and the, mm-hmm. There's a control which goes to the rudder, and there's a time delay. Mm. And so the automatic indicator says, well, you want to be going north, and you turn the rudder a certain way, and then because of the time delay, you may overshoot. Mm-hmm. And so then you got to steer back. This was a novel about people stealing ideas. I didn't really like mm-hmm. the novel, but also you learn about feedback control. And so there are time mm-hmm. delays. Then the ship, and you try to control it strongly, what happens is the ship can just roll over. Mm-hmm. And sink. And apparently that did happen with one ship due to the automatic control mm-hmm. somewhere around 1900. Science fiction novel written in around 1950 talking about science of 1900. Mm-hmm. So nonetheless, it's all about science. And mm-hmm. So you see there, you learn something mm-hmm. and I've been interested in control theory a bit ever since. And my most cited paper is actually a paper with Ed Ott and Graboji mm-hmm. on controlling chaos. So, these ideas become part of you, and mm-hmm. and you see, I learn these things without any mathematics. That mm-hmm. is, no equations. You just understand. You get a feeling for them. And so, when I give lectures, I'm often giving lectures with very few equations.
Oh, good.
Okay. even the technical lectures.
Mm-hmm.
So so these two guys were mentors,
mm-hmm.
and the ways they taught me how to think about problems. And Einstein did his special relativity in 1905, among other topics.
Mm-hmm.
And this was based on basically a theory of light, and he thinks of light as a wave.
Mm-hmm.
And now you would think that if you thought up a way to overthrow Newton by treating light as a wave, you'd be locked into that idea.
Mm-hmm.
However, the same year, he wrote the first paper on quantum mechanics where the author actually believed it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a previous one by Planck where it looks like he didn't really believe it. It was a computational trick.
Mm-hmm.
And so here in 1905, he writes the idea of light as a particle and the photoelectric effect, where photons would hit one spot and they would kick an electron loose.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he creates relativity based on the nature of light as a wave. Now, that is just mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody could be so divergent. And so let's... those are my two mentors.
Mm-hmm. Another of your famous papers is Period 3 Implies Chaos.
Yes.
And that appeared in the Monthly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In 1973, I think. Somewhere around
75,
there.
I think.
75, right. And how did that come about? I mean, Monthly isn't the usual place for it, and right now it remains now on JSTOR one of the top 10 downloaded papers of anything that's ever appeared in the Monthly.
Ah.
So it's still very much in circulation.
Only the top 10.
Oh. Well, could be in the top 3 or 4.
Okay.
No, the top one is something about the marriage problem.
Okay. Well, I had submitted a paper to Science one time, and I got such bizarre referee reports, mm-hmm. where one referee says, you use an identity in this paper,
mm-hmm.
and identities are always true, therefore you can't learn anything from them. And this was some kind of a criticism of why our paper shouldn't be published.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so I had given up on that. So I said, well, where is a place where I can talk to the most people?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was the Monthly. And I thought it would be a neat idea with my collaborator Lee,
mm-hmm.
and who was then a student. And so we sent it to the Monthly, and after going back and forth a bit, it got published, and it was a great place to publish it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was where you gave a new meaning to the word chaos.
Yes, yes. Now, we coined the term chaos,
mm-hmm.
but a curious aspect of this. Now, I feel that one of the roles of mathematicians in science is to create definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And to creating a definition tells people how to think of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not define chaos in that paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the lecture I most like to give right now is Aspects of Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that about is, do you remember the story of the maybe 3 blind men who encounter an elephant?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's 6 men,
mm-hmm.
blind men who encounter an elephant. And one. See, about half the people know this story well, and half the people don't know mm-hmm. this that I encounter. And one grabs onto the elephant's leg, and it's like a pillar, and the ear is like a fan where you fan somebody to mm-hmm. cool them off, and so on. And they all get different aspects, views of the aspects.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out this story is 2,500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the Buddhist literature. And it tells you that the point of the story is that if you only know one aspect of God, then you're very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I turn the story around. If you only know one aspect of chaos,
mm-hmm.
you've got a very limited view mm-hmm. of what chaos is. And chaos comes up, it reveals itself in a number of different ways. And so I go through the different ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you completed your graduate studies, you stayed at Maryland, essentially, at the same institute.
At the same university. I switched departments
because
I went to the Institute for Fluid Dynamics and Applied Mathematics.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
And so I switched departments.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually got back in the math department several years later. And then I joined the physics department several years later.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm chairman of the math department. But I haven't left.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there since 1963. And it was a good place for me, so.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was in the Institute for Fluid Dynamics and Applied Mathematics, which is now essentially the Institute for Physical Science and Technology,
mm-hmm.
A faculty member named Alan Fowler showed me a paper of Edward Lorenz,
mm-hmm.
Which is now a very famous paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I read this paper, and my paper, Period 3 Implies Chaos, was a response to explain what Edward Lorenz was talking about, in part. And he was seeing
mm-hmm.
chaos in a three-dimensional system of ordinary differential equations. And he was also showing how it could kind of be reduced to a one-dimensional map
mm-hmm.
on an interval. So our paper with my student T.Y. Lee basically said, well, if you have a one-dimensional map which is continuous and you have a point of period 3, you start with one point, you come back after your third iterative comes back to where you started exactly, then you're going to have many kinds of behaviors, one of which is you'd have periodic orbits of each period. That is, if you take period 17, for example,
mm-hmm.
there would be an initial point. If you started exactly at that initial point,
mm-hmm.
iterated 17 times, you'd come back, not before, but only on your 17th iterative. And this would be true for every integer. There'd be some initial point. We also said that, now that result turned out to be a special case of Sharkovsky's theorem, a Ukrainian scientist,
mm-hmm.
mathematician. But we also said other things, so that there was an uncountable set of trajectories which somewhere along the way we called scrambled. Now imagine scrambling an egg, and just imagine scrambling it forever without it ever congealing,
mm-hmm.
and just picture two atoms in this mess, and they'll come arbitrarily close to
mm-hmm.
each other and go apart. And even closer together and go apart,
mm-hmm.
and even closer together and go apart. They'll become arbitrarily close along some sequence of times, but they'll also continuously go apart. So we said this pair was scrambled.
Mm-hmm.
And so we showed there was an uncountable set of points, such that any two points was a scrambled pair. And that's often called Lee-York chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But see, this is one aspect of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect is many periods. Which one do you choose?
Mm-hmm.
See, one is kind of a mixing property. The other is a periodic orbit property. Neither reveals what chaos is about
mm-hmm.
in its entirety. So we didn't give a definition.
But this is all built into the mathematics and into the
yes,
all behavior differential equations.
One theorem, yes.
Yeah.
Actually, mappings on an interval, which are suggested by differential equations,
mm-hmm.
yes. So Lee and I had a great time with this.
Mm-hmm.
And this part of the scrambled set is... there's a funny story. It's a three-continent story. And it goes like the following. That right around when the paper was published, there was a meeting of Western mathematicians with the Russian mathematicians for essentially the first time. They met in Poland. And one of the Russians apparently was saying, our guy Sharkovsky has a better paper than your guys Lee and York, because he did a better job, more thorough job of talking about the periodic orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Westerners, the Americans and the Western Europeans, believed all this, and so they didn't feel there's any need to read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians believed it, and so they felt there's no reason to read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
But, so many people believe today that the paper is a special case of Sharkovsky's
mm-hmm.
theorem, which it is not. It's only one theorem in the paper. In Asia, they read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, in China, Korea, throughout the Eastern Asia, this paper is a big topic, and Lee York chaos
mm-hmm.
is a big topic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm exaggerating. I mean, you know, you can't categorize everybody in
right.
one group, so, but it's a tendency.
Mm-hmm.
And there was recently a paper, someone wrote a letter to the editor of the American Math Society Notices saying, this is 2 years ago, saying, period three implies chaos is a special case of Sharkovsky's theorem.
Mm.
Now, why would they do that? It's hard to believe. But they did it without reading the theorem.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? Getting a big audience.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Happens.
Happens.
Yes.
You've got to be careful.
Yeah.
But, see, that indicates
yeah.
this particular guy is a very knowledgeable guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, he was fooled into this story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is many years after.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is now, basically.
Yes. But there's predilection to believe certain kinds of things. And it gets built in. You don't always check.
Right.
Now, you mentioned some of the things that you're working on now, the genome projects in particular and all that. What are sort of the exciting questions that, or the questions that excite you right now?
Here's one question. I'm working with Miguel San Juan from Madrid on this topic, and we've been working for a few years. And I think this is a fantastic topic, but we haven't really convinced the audiences that it's a fantastic topic.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, what you have is you have a chaotic system. So I think in terms of discrete time, and it could be from a differential equation, could be whatever. And you apply the map, then you apply noise, and then you apply control. I liken it the following. Suppose you're trying to raise a teenager. Okay? You do not control the teenager. You do not try to say, here is the trajectory
mm-hmm.
that you are going to follow. You really try to pick out some bad spots to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to think of it. Also, you might try to push the person in a positive direction,
mm-hmm.
knowing that you have very limited influence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, control theory, standard control theory says you pick out a trajectory, often an equilibrium point, an unstable equilibrium point, and you want to control it and enforce this trajectory to be the actual trajectory. So if you have this trajectory you want to follow, and it's an unstable one, then you add noise, and then you add your control. Your control has to dominate the noise, so your
mm-hmm.
control has to be bigger than the noise. Okay? I think everybody would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If, however, it's also well known that if you try to control situations too strongly, you often wind up with a very adverse result. And the example was this ship that rolls over. If you try to control it too strongly, try to turn the rudder too much, then with the feedback, it can roll over. Okay, so what I learned in high school. See? And at the same time, what we talk about is where you apply your mapping, you add noise, and then you add a weaker control where the maximum value of the control is maybe half the size of the noise. Now this means you cannot control it to do anything particular, but can you avoid certain situations? And so my feeling is anybody who runs any organization, you're running the MAA, okay? You want to make sure certain things don't happen. And that's what this kind of control theory is about. You want to avoid certain situations. You want to raise a teenager. You want to make sure certain things don't happen. You don't want your teenager to get pregnant or get somebody pregnant, and you don't want them to get into drugs, and you don't want to drop out of school, and you may succeed in some of these and not others. You want them to stay alive. You want them to stay out of jail. So how do you do this? What is the theory behind this? And this is what we call partial control. You see, the actual course of the trajectory is not picked out by you or me, but rather we avoid certain bad paths. And the way we actually do this is, you can imagine the following. You're jumping across a very long, very wide stream, and there are rocks in the stream. And you can jump over and land on a rock. And you have to then immediately jump to another rock. But since you are not very good at jumping at the rock, you don't hit it dead on. And so you might be overbalanced in one direction or another, and so you have to jump for a different rock. So how you're overbalanced determines which path you take, but you're successful if you continue to jump from rock to rock. Okay? But you don't choose ahead of time which sequence of rocks, because it's too unstable for you to do so.
But overall, there is a direction, and you end up where you want to go.
So the way we phrase this is, we call this survival. And you never win the game. But the point is, you don't lose the game. So you have to keep on surviving, going from rock to rock to rock. And it's simplest just to have the thing run on forever. And this is what we call partial control. I think it's a fantastic topic. But we haven't convinced anybody. And I've come up with a neat theorem about this and in the last couple days, in fact. But we've been working on this for several years. So it's a lot of fun. Intriguing idea.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I haven't ever heard of anything like this.
Although there was... I've heard before of the sense of it's not so much, I mean, controlling chaos, it just takes small inputs to control.
So when we control chaos, our control is stronger than any noise.
Yes, right.
When we partially control it, the reverse is true.
Right. But even whatever control you apply, it's putting a bias into the noise. It's creating a kind of bias.
Well, you're biasing it so that you don't fall in the river.
Yeah. Intriguing question.
Right. And we can do this with, for example, you take a chaotic force-damped pendulum and you can try to avoid certain sets. And so then force-damped pendulum, you can create time 2π map, or, mm-hmm. so that once each cycle, it's a stroboscopic map, and we can identify certain safe mm-hmm. sets. So see, these rocks are the safe sets.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you keep hitting the rocks,
mm-hmm.
you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can produce a set of points
mm-hmm.
which is safe, and mm-hmm. given any point on the safe set, for any noise, you can then put your control to push you back to mm-hmm. a safe point.
Anything else you want to add to the interview? We've covered a lot of things already.
All right. So I would just say that about 15 years ago, I got interested in this DNA.
Yes.
And my collaborators and I work on trying to figure out the DNA sequence. And we weren't able to make much of an impact until a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they take several copies of a genome
mm-hmm.
and they break it into small overlapping fragments.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try to piece it together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, the rat genome was determined with errors,
mm-hmm.
lots of errors, but generally it's correct, and this was considered a solved problem as to how to do it. Well, if there are lots of errors, you can hope
mm-hmm.
to do better.
Mm-hmm.
But about 3 years ago, some companies came up with much cheaper ways of producing the data. So when the rat cost $40 million for the data, roughly,
mm-hmm.
today you could do it for well under $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
However, what happened is that the data, the much cheaper data, was much cheaper in quality.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of fragments of 700 letters long, you get fragments of, let's say, 100 letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so until the end of last year, only two genomes had been published. One was the panda genome by the Beijing mm-hmm. Genome Institute. And the other was the turkey genome. We missed Thanksgiving publication, mm-hmm. but. And now we have many collaborators on this. Mm-hmm. Our job is to put together the actual sequence, but theirs is to try to interpret it and find mm-hmm. interesting properties of these.
Mm-hmm.
So there are quite a few collaborators, but we are specialists. Mm-hmm. It's a very mathematical puzzle in some sense, mm-hmm. a very logical puzzle. And right around then, we developed a new way to put together genomes,
mm.
which was good. We developed the idea to do it, and mm-hmm. we've been working on it for a year. Right after that, in January and February, a couple of the old assembly programs got a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
So our competition suddenly
mm-hmm.
got a lot more muscle.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is a... So you're on top of the world, and then 2 months later,
right.
you're one of the pack. But we were developing this new technique,
mm-hmm.
Which we think is very promising. And we are currently working on a problem, put together a pine tree genome, which is funded
mm-hmm.
by the Department of Agriculture. See, pine trees are a commercial crop.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a loblolly pine that we're working on right now. And the primary grant is from Davis, California, the
mm-hmm.
University of California, Davis. And we are a subcontractor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using this new technique. The thing is that this thing is, the genome is 7 times as big as anything that was put together
mm-hmm.
before. So, in particular, 7 times as big as a human genome. And that was put together with the good data.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the crap data. And we've got to do something which is much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a challenge. It's a mm-hmm. great challenge. And So, I'm also department chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have a great success as a chair doing something or other, it makes me smile a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But when I have a success in a mathematical problem or a scientific problem, that really makes my day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just total discontinuity in those in that regard.
But clearly part of the fun is also thinking of the problems and looking at
working
at
things and working making steps and making progress.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you've been able to do that through your career.
Yeah.
All the way.
Yeah. And when you get to be chairman, it takes so much time.
Mm-hmm.
You get bits and pieces of time. Yeah. And I always work with collaborators. Last time I wrote a paper by myself was 1970, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that people can add ideas, and you put in the mix,
mm-hmm.
and I add three ideas, and the other person adds three ideas. Is that 3 and 3 is 6, or 3 times 3 is 9?
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as 3 times 3 is 9. I mean, it's a great package of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.